There had been abuse in my family, but it was mostly musical in nature.
Are you ready to get your world rocked?
Ready!
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
Do it!
1, 2, 3, 4!
After a 10-year hiatus, Slater-Kinney is back and as good as ever. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. Original Riot Girls Carrie Brownstein, Corin Tucker, and Janet Weiss join us in the studio for a performance and chat about the past, present, and future of the band. Then we review the new album from another Pacific Northwest giant, Death Cab for Cutie. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
This is Sound Opinions, and Jim, as I look at this show, I realize we've got a Pacific Northwest theme going here.
Yeah.
You know, it's dark and foggy outside. We've got the coffee pumping here.
Got some salmon for breakfast.
There you go. And then we've got two bands that have really put the Pacific Northwest on the map, in addition to many others. But today, Slater-Kinney and Death Cab for Cutie, two bands that got their starts in the 90s and still going strong today.
That's later in the show, but first we have some music news.
Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, how do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul? And can you teach me how to dance real slow?
That, of course, is Don McLean with American Pie, one of those songs, Jim, I remember still parsing that song in an English class in the 70s. My English teacher was very enamored with those six verses spread over 8.5 minutes. That song has been so widely discussed that I think it explains why an anonymous bidder spent $1.2 million for the song's original manuscript at a Christie's auction in New York recently.
Well, it was 16 pages long.
16 pages, and apparently what's in those 16 pages is McLean's work process as he was going through the song, the way he wrote those lyrics and what possibly inspired them, because he's been very cryptic. For McLean, he has been very upfront about the fact that the song begins or was inspired by the events of 1959 when Buddy Holly's plane went down. That's the day the music died. Buddy Holly died, Ritchie Valens, the Big Bopper. So there's been a lot of speculation about what the song's about. But there's all sorts of questions, right? Who's the jester that sang for the King and Queen? Was it Dylan? Who were the King and Queen? Was it Pete Seeger and Joan Baez? Some people
JFK,
say it.
Right,
exactly. So to me, the great mystery, Jim, has always been who's the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost that are mentioned in the last verse. I mean, some people have said it's Janis Hendrix and Jim Morrison who died around that time. Popular theories that he's talking about Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and Big Bopper again, bringing the song full circle. I mean, who would you say it would be?
I think it's the members of Rush.
I like that one.
If you're disappointed that you didn't get to buy Don McLean's lyrics, you can still bid on a piece of rock history. Greg, on May 16th, the estate of Davy Jones, the singer of the Monkees, who died in 2012 of a heart attack, he was 66, they're going to be auctioning off some of his collection. You know, there's the usual stuff, the gold and the platinum records, but then there's some really interesting things. One of those red and white striped coats, you know, that they would occasionally wear in some of the set pieces where they'd be singing. My favorite thing, though, there's guitars, there's amplifiers, and there's a tambourine. Because after Linda McCartney of Wings, I contend Davy Jones, the most famous tambourine in rock history. But let's go back to the Don McLean American Pie story and throw it out to the listeners. What do you think McLean's song is about? And what other lyrics have you been parsing for years now without quite figuring out? Give us a call on the Sound Opinions hotline, 888-859-1800. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that's the song Fangless, a new tune by our guest this week, Slater-Kinney. The Olympia Washington Band was one of a few Riot Girl groups from the region to get worldwide attention. We're talking about bands like Heavens to Betsy, Excuse 17, and Bikini Kill that helped galvanize feminist rockers and fans in the 90s. Slater Kinney, whose name comes from the road off Interstate 5 in Lacey, Washington, was formed in 1994 by Corin Tucker, who'd been in Heavens to Betsy, and Carrie Brownstein, who was in Excuse 17. With a series of drummers, they made several critically acclaimed albums and grew a large and devoted fan base. Cot, you were originally the fan club president, I do believe. Then they decided to go on indefinite hiatus. Suddenly, that came out of the blue after the release of The Woods in 2005. Greg, I know you shed a tear or two when you heard that.
Jim, I don't know if devastated quite does it, but I was pretty upset when they broke up. I thought they were a band at their very peak, and I was surprised that they broke up at that time. But now they're back. Carrie, Korn, and Janet Weiss, who's been Slater Kinney's drummer since 1996, have released their new album, No Cities to Love, to a lot of anticipation. Now, one of the reasons I didn't think they would get back together again is that in the interim, Carrie went on to be one half of that comedy duo behind Portlandia with Fred Armisen, which was hugely successful. And she also played in that great band Wild Flag with Janet Weiss. Now, the three members of Slater Kinney stopped by the studios for a career-spanning interview recently. Now, Jim, you weren't able to be there, but I started the conversation by taking them back to the beginning. Here, Corin Tucker explains why she decided to form a band with Carrie Brownstein.
Well, I was really a fan of Carrie's guitar playing, and I just thought it would be fun to write with her because she was such a wicked guitar player. So we just tried it, you know, as like an idea or a project, and it just seemed to have kind of an instant chemistry.
Carrie, did it click right away for you? Did you see some long-term potential in what you were doing with Korn at that point?
I mean, I think at the time we weren't thinking about long-term potential. I think in the moment it felt very exciting. We'd been fans of each other's playing. I was a huge fan of Korin's singing. I really wanted to be in a band with Korin from the first time I saw Heavens to Betsy play.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about hearing Korin's voice, what was it about it that was speaking to you?
I think it didn't ask for anything. It just told, and it was unapologetic. It was scary. And it said more in a, you know, a single note or a series of notes than, you know, most people, you know, need a whole song to say what Korn can say really, really briefly.
Some context here too. The Riot Girl scene, Olympia was a big hotbed of that. I mean, you had lots of groups around in that scene. Korn, put it in context for us. Where do you see what you and Carrie were doing in the early days of Slater Kinney in the context of Riot Girl?
Well, I think that we were just part of this really incredibly community-oriented scene that was really almost matriarchal in Olympia. Like there really were so many women who had access to putting out records, putting on shows, organizing their own tours. Everyone was doing it. So to get into that scene, it was an excellent opportunity to be like, I'm going to do it too. You know, and it just provided this incredible context for our band to just immediately, you know, start doing what we wanted to do and be able to immediately start putting out records. I think that was, you know, when you think about that in terms of the, you know, the larger context of the music industry, it was completely unique.
Yeah, it seemed to me too extra musical, which was great, but, you know, I definitely sensed, you know, I was working, and I still do, work for the Chicago Tribune. It was very difficult to do media at all with these bands. We were interested in writing about them, but there was often like, hey, we don't want anything to do with any of you people. It was kind of like, just get away. We're doing our own thing here. Leave us alone. How did you see it, Korn? I mean, where did you see it fitting in from that standpoint of there was a certain amount of circling the wagons going on there, and, you know, justifiably so, I would imagine, you know? But where did you see it from that standpoint?
Well, I think that before Sleater-Kinney ever became a band, you know, the real Riot Grrrl movement had really tried to speak out about a lot of different feminist issues, and we had already had some just intensely negative experiences with mainstream media. And so we just felt like there was like this incredible scrutiny of what we were trying to do that did feel a bit exploitative. And so, you know, that kind of explains the kind of reaction of the people who were involved with the movement of saying like, wait a minute, you know, we're not even ready to deal with mainstream media. And the whole point of it was to be able to get out our own thoughts and our own words.
Carrie, the vocabulary that you and Korn have together as guitar players is pretty fascinating. It reminds me a little bit of that old Keith Richards quote about the ancient art of weaving. You know, there's no kind of lead rhythm roles. It's kind of very tangled up. Was that there from the start? Were you talking to each other with your guitars that way from the start?
I think so. I think in some ways we learned how to play guitar in relation to one another, even though we had been playing beforehand, in terms of what you hear now on a Sleater-Kinney record or even on the earlier records. You know, it's this kind of partial, you know, chord formations that don't make a lot of sense until the other person's playing their part. And it is very interwoven, and it is a kind of specific vernacular. And it's just, there's kind of like a sourness to it sometimes. We detune to C sharp, so even when we're trying to do something catchy, you know, there's still like sort of a lump in the back of the throat of the song.
Right, right. Which is great. And people remarked on this early on. It was like probably the oldest question you guys heard. Well, there's no bass player in the band, you know. But it seemed like almost the way you two played guitar together made that superfluous, Korn. It seemed like, hey, we just don't have space for it in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, I almost think having another person would have distracted from what we were doing in a way, because we were taking up all the space that we could with the two guitars.
We're going to return and get back on this point here. We'll bring Janet Weiss into the conversation, but we're going to hear a song first. What are you guys going to play for us?
This song is called Price Tag, and it's the first song off our record, No Cities to Love.
Thank you.
Wow. Price tag from Slater Kinney, Kerry Brownstein, Corin Tucker, Janet Weiss, Katie Harkin. We have to talk about that song. First song on your first record in almost a decade. I mean, that, you know, you got to come out of the box with something good, right? Why is that song at the top? It's obviously a terrific song, but there had to be some jostling about what's going to be in that first position. Why did you pick that song, Corin?
I think that it kind of embodied who we want to be as a band today, you know, which is just all of the musicianship and everything that we do, but also all of our values and just everything is just completely on the table at that point. You know, like we're all in, we're screaming about what we care about. Everyone's just playing their heart out. And I think that's, we just, if we wanted to come back into being, it's like we wanted to resurrect the band. We wanted to do it just all in right away.
We'll have more of Greg's conversation with the members of Slater Kinney in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. And later in the show, we'll review the latest from Death Cab for Cutie, whose leader, Ben Gibbard, is weathering some changes in his life. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and our guest this week is Slater Kinney. Kerry Brownstein, Corin Tucker, and Janet Weiss joined Greg in the studio to talk about this pioneering band's origin and the evolution of its sound. Greg, I know you'd agree. I say this not just because I'm a drummer, but one of the catalysts toward making Slater Kinney so influential was the addition of Janet Weiss on drums. We'd heard her before in Quasi and after in Wild Flag, along with Kerry Brownstein. As we return to the conversation, here's Janet talking about what made her want to join Kerry and Corin.
I think from the first time I saw them, it was the not only the immediacy and the propulsion and the aggression that I really related to, but it was how their music felt very meaningful, and I wanted to play music that held meaning to me and to people who heard it. I wanted to pursue this as like a way to communicate with people things that I cared about and to hold a place in their lives that made a difference to them. And this was a band that from the first note conveyed that in spades. And so I mean, I think at the first show, I said to myself, yeah, I could be in this band.
Wow.
And, funnily enough, it came true.
Corin, what was it about Janet that you had the Spinal Tap thing going with the drummers there for a while, and Janet's the one who stuck around? What was it about Janet that was different than everybody else?
She just brought it so much harder. I mean, the minute she sat down behind that drum kit, she was so powerful. She was so talented, and she had learned all of our material the first day that we rehearsed with her. She had learned everything, and she was just ready to go. She was just brought, you know, such an intensity to our band, you know, that it just made us into a rock band at that point.
So, Carrie, that Dig Me Out record, you're looking back on it, and you guys had reissued a lot of your material before this reunion was official. But I would imagine you went back and listened to some of this material at that point. How does Dig Me Out hold up for you in terms of where you were? Did you feel it like it was a turning point for the band in some ways?
Yeah, I mean, it was a clear turning point. We were on tour with Dig Me Out in the middle of the country, probably Nebraska or Kansas, and we stopped for gas and went in, and our roadie came out with Time Magazine, and there was a review of Dig Me Out, and it was very surreal. Like, things were just happening concomitant to us being on the road, but there was also this kind of disproportionate sense of, like, that this record was catching on. We were still kind of doing the same thing, but we could start feeling this energy at the shows, and that, you know, it definitely felt like we had tapped into something, or that we had kind of created a space that other people wanted to tap into. I'm not sure which is which, but it definitely felt just like this collective push for agitation, togetherness, like forcefulness, and yeah, it was just this, it felt like a real wave. I think the album still holds up quite a bit. We play a lot from it on this tour,
mm-hmm.
and we only really picked songs that still felt meaningful to us, and there's definitely a handful on that record.
Corn, you mentioned earlier about coming out of Riot Girl, and you know there was a certain amount of insularity there. Now you're in these big media, whether you wanted to be there or not, they were paying attention to your band. Did it change the dynamic within the way you guys wrote songs, the way you approached each other, the way you approached your audience? Because I could imagine, I know that when certain bands get put in a particular scene early on, there's fans who want to hold on to that, and they feel betrayed when the band grows beyond that. How was it for Slater Kinney at what I could imagine must have been a really exciting period for the band?
Yeah, I mean, it was confusing because all those things you described happened at once. You know, we had this kind of dream come true of becoming popular enough where we could imagine ourselves even making a living at what we were doing. And, you know, at the same time, you know, some people immediately called us sellouts, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I just think that the three of us had kind of a bigger picture in mind of being able to maybe open some doors with our music, you know, for other people that were like us, other women who wanted to imagine themselves doing something that maybe people hadn't seen before. I think we always had this larger goal in mind of reaching more people, you know, by doing larger press pieces or having larger audiences.
Mm-hmm. And what about playing in front of those larger crowds? There's a whole different dynamic that goes on. Was it daunting for you guys at first to, like, you know, graduate from playing to 200, 300 people who were deeply invested in you to bigger rooms where people were curious because they read about you in Time magazine?
Well, I think that, you know, we learned to deal with that kind of pressure in a lot of different ways over the years. I mean, at some points we dealt with hostility and frustration from different crowds, you know, opening for maybe even a larger band that wasn't our crowd. We always would try and work around that to get people's attention, to get people to notice us, to get people to see us as something different than maybe they would judge us at first glance. And so we did that with our music over and over again. You come knocking on my door. Pull me, pick me off the floor. I might need something to get me going. Feel it worn down. It rolls.
Well, it was extremely successful in a standpoint, just from a musical standpoint. And Janet, I want to ask you about this because Carrie and Korn are sort of associated with the songs because they sing them, but I know you have a big role in them too. And in terms of the variety of material, you know, I was going through the records the other night and I was thinking, you know, a song like Step Aside was a really cool soul song. there was like a blues, what was it, Light Rayed Coyote, you know, a great blues. And then this 11-minute track on, you know, the 2005 record, Let's Call It Love. Kind of a pop thing going on in Leave Me Behind. I mean, all this variety of music, very eclectic. Jumping into the band, and, you know, I hesitate to say you were responsible for the variety alone. Obviously, it was the whole band, but it seemed like there was a big leap in the stylistic range of the material during that period of time. And how did you sort of fit into that?
I think it's just a reflection of our tastes as music listeners. I think we grew up listening to radio that was very diverse. You know, me in the 70s, them in the 80s, like, you know, you would hear Bob Dylan's Sly and the Family Stone, you know, right back to back. There were just, I was exposed to so many different styles that I loved. And I think that just worked its way into my playing. Sometimes on the way to practice, I hear a song and I want to, let's goof around with a style like that. You know, I mean, I think Step Aside, I had thought about Land of a Thousand Dances. And, you know, just the break in that song, I think, is so fantastic. And ideas like that to just sort of spur on creativity for us, I think it works that way for all of us. You know, hearing a whole lot of love on the way to practice and thinking like, wow, we could have a section where it's just crazy guitar for, you know, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like just hearing something on the radio, I think that takes a lot of chances, was exciting to me and made me feel like you don't have to stay within a particular box to reach people. And I think that is ultimately our goal, is to reach people and share our music with them. So I think sort of exploring these different styles is really pushes us and is challenging for us and fun.
So Janet, to follow up on that, it seems like, would the songs go through different permutations?
They can, yes. On this most recent record, the songs took a little bit longer to complete. I think we realized we needed to put together a very strong, and we wanted it to be a very concise group of songs. So we really went through and cut all the fat and edited down the songs to their most pure and clean forms. We wanted them to be sort of daunting and immediate. So in that case, you know, sometimes a chorus would change 4 or 5 times, you know, and not that the earlier permutations weren't good, they just weren't right.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all very interested in exploring different possibilities until we find the right combination of things, because it is very intricate. And like you mentioned, this weaving thing, it's like sometimes it takes me a while to find my place in those guitar parts, you know, or to express what I want to say in like a very, you know, certain specific amount of space.
Mm-hmm.
So some things take quite a while. Some things are quicker. This record was a little bit more of a, you know, really honing down the songs and spending the time we needed to make sure they were good enough.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. We're here with Slater Kinney, and we're going to hear another song. What do we got lined up?
This one is called No Cities to Love, and it's the title track from our new record.
There are no cities, no cities to love. There are no cities, no cities to love. It's not the cities, it's the weather we love.
No Cities to Love from Sleater-Kinney, Carrie, Corin, Janet, and Katie on that track. Wow, that's the title track from the new album, and we want to talk about that. But the road to this new record started in 2006, really. I mean, I still have the press release there. It wasn't even a press release. I think it was on your website. Last line of which, after 11 years, 7 albums together. As of now, there are no plans for future tours or recordings. And you could hear the wailing and the gnashing of teeth. What was the finality of it, Carrie? How did you feel at that point? Did you really see a point where this would ever, you know, there would be another set of shows and albums with Sleater-Kinney?
I do think that we chose the word hiatus very purposefully. I don't think that we saw it with a sense of finality. We went out, we thought at a good time. I think a lot of bands don't end necessarily when they should. They keep going. And The Woods had been such a game changer for us. You know, we really surprised the audience. We surprised ourselves. We brought in so many new fans. And it was kind of like putting the brakes on in the middle of something very momentous. But I think because we didn't sort of fizzle out, it was easier to start back up again.
I read some interviews you gave a year or so ago where you kind of put the blame on yourself in some ways. You were kind of the one who was saying, you know, I had some health issues at that point, and I didn't feel like I could keep going.
Yeah, I think tour was just really stressful for me. My body was, like, rejecting it constantly. I was always getting, like, psychosomatic, hypochondriacal kinds of things on the road. I felt like I was, like, touring emergency rooms. I've seen so many,
yeah.
You know, because I would just like, oh my God, I have hives. I have to go to the hospital or having a panic attack. And yeah, I mean, my body was just basically like, you're done.
Corin, were you ready for the band to break up or how did you feel in 2006 when it happened?
I mean, we talked about it for a while before we came to that decision. You know, it was a group decision where we all discussed it and we really felt like it was the right thing to do. It wasn't easy, but, you know, it was like, we really need to take a break. And, you know, I definitely wanted to have another child and really needed to be completely off the road. So, you know, there was more than one thing going on at the time. And I think that it was the right thing for us to do, you know, to take the hiatus.
Mm-hmm. So all three of you got involved in some very interesting projects. Janet played in 300 bands. Corin, you had the family. You released a couple solo records. Carrie, you were doing some work as a writer, and then this Portlandia thing happened as part of this whole equation. You were also in Wild Flag, which we loved. But so, Corin, you're the band member that has known Carrie the longest. Did you see a Portlandia in her future?
Yes. I mean, people ask me that question, and they ask if she was funny, and she was always cracking me up. From day one, she had some silly joke that she was doing. She had all these funny voices that she would do. So, you know, I know that she always loved comedy and she was really funny.
Janet, how about you, your perspective on it? Because I think Sleater-Kinney had a reputation as being a very serious, intense band.
I think that's often the case with the most serious musicians. They're often very funny.
Mm-hmm.
I played with Elliot Smith as well, who was hilarious and always making us laugh.
Now you're blowing my mind.
And people thought, oh, he's like, you know, such a downer, and we would have to disagree. But I think I think Carrie has the way she observes the world is very unique, and the way she can write and comment on the world, obviously, in her music is very vital and interesting and always takes you by surprise, and I think that sort of taking you by surprise is part of what Portlandia does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it kind of knocks you off your seat and makes you feel, you know, sort of weird and uncomfortable.
Where's your air conditioning unit?
Sir, I don't think that you're allowed to come into this store and talk about units. Every time you say the word unit or box or equipment, I feel a penis here, I feel a penis here, I feel a penis here. I am halfway to pregnant. We'll call this from now on an air conditioner or chill machine.
A chill machine.
Or a chill unit.
Where's
we can call it a chill unit.
No, we
chill
cannot
machine.
Call it a chill unit. We
Did
will,
I say unit?
We
I'm
will
so
strike
sorry.
The word unit from this conversation.
It entered into my subconscious. I'm so sorry.
And I think that that's how our music is in a way, and it just sort of translates into Portlandia as well. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of her as a musician in the show.
So, Carrie, multiple streams of art going on here. Do you see any of what Portlandia, what you're doing in Portlandia, or the creative energies that you're putting into Portlandia crossing over into the way you are writing songs or approaching guitar now in Sleater-Kinney?
Not really. I mean, except for what Janet's talking about in that kind of like observational tool that I like to keep sharp. And I guess from a collaborative perspective, I have learned a lot from Fred and from being in a writer's room. And when you're pitching ideas, you can't really be precious about them. You have a limited amount of time. And I think that we kind of applied some of that in the writing on this record, just being like less, you know, sort of like married to our ideas and like willing to sort of see someone else's opinion or have them just be like, this is not the best idea. And so in terms of like the logistics and the methodology, I think that applies, but not in terms of, there's nothing really jokey about my playing, I don't think.
Yeah, I wouldn't say joke is the word we would use to apply to that. All right, new album. And I know, Janet, you were somewhat outspoken in some interviews about, there's no way I'm going to do this unless it's absolutely right. Like the standards had already been set. And I know that all of you are students of music history and know that 9 times out of 10, whatever you want to call it, reunion, reincarnation, resurrection, 9 times out of 10, those things don't go well, especially with new material on the block to be compared to the previous material that you guys had done. You guys, as you mentioned, The Woods was an extraordinary record in 2005. So, Janet, what was your feeling about, we're putting the band back together again, man?
Well, that's exactly what Corin said to me in that voice. Hey, man.
Hey, man.
I mean, I think the initial concern was just to make sure we had enough time, we could make enough space for it to be good enough. I think we all realized we were going to be under the microscope on this one. And I think we not only compare our music to our previous albums, but to all music. I think we want our record to stand up with all the great albums. I think we're striving for making songs that are going to stick around for a while. And so I think we just pushed and pushed and pushed on this and really tried to do our best work, which we try every time, but mm-hmm. You know, sometimes more successful than other times. I think the Woods was far enough behind us to where we weren't feeling any sort of, you know, pressure to play one way or another in reaction to the most recent record, which is often the case. You're kind of come off a record and try to go in a different direction. I think we felt almost, you know, like starting over in a way, and we had more choices, and we could sort of express ourselves in a current and kind of natural way. So the songs that came out of us, I think, you know, they didn't feel so much a reaction to The Woods. They felt more, you know, really anchored in the moment.
Corin, was a degree of difficulty on making this record? Because, again, sort of the legacy thing. We actually interviewed Frank Black, a.k.a. Black Francis, in the show a few years ago. And at that point, the Pixies had been doing years and years of reunion shows and no new material. And he goes, you know, and he kind of was really open about it. I'm a little scared about doing something because he didn't think, you know, there's just no way we're going to live up to, you know, what we've done before. So how do you overcome that as a band? Because you obviously had set a bar for yourself.
I mean, I think all three of us were just, we just opened the door fully before we started writing, you know? And like, we all went into it ready to try anything. Like, I think Carrie's, the way she was talking about being open to each other's ideas and each other's criticism too, kind of that really helped us weed through a lot of different ideas, you know, that we were willing to hear, like, I don't think that chorus is fully baked, or I don't think the song really, you know, belongs on the record. I mean, I think that we all went in willing to work extra hard to make something that we were proud of.
You probably are aware of it now, but I'm wondering if you were aware of it in the process. The intensity of this record is really high, which was not unexpected, but no ballads. I mean, it just hits you in the face right from the start and pretty much doesn't let up. Was that that just the way it came out, or was that like a statement of purpose? We're coming out, you know, we're throwing haymakers right from the start.
I think that's what we wanted. I mean, we had, you know, several other songs. We tried some different ideas. We did try something that was almost a slow song, but it just didn't feel, desperate enough to express how we felt about this band, you know, how, you know, the emotions that are tied up with this band are so much bigger than just the three of us, you know? And so I think that we weren't satisfied with the configurations until it was kind of a whammy of a record.
It's been a real pleasure having Slater Kinney in the studio today. Guys, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
To watch video of Slater Kinney's entire performance, including bonus songs not heard during the broadcast, visit soundopinions.org. And we want to hear from you. Was the new Slater Kinney record worth the wait? What about the live shows? And who's another band you'd like to see come back from hiatus? Call 888-859-1800. Coming up, a review of the new album from Death Cab for Cutie. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. That is the song Black Sun from the new album by Death Cab for Cutie, the eighth of that group's career. The record, Greg, is called Kintsugi, which is a Japanese art form that involves fixing broken pottery with fancy gold leaf. That'll make sense in a minute. First, a little background on Death Cab for Cutie. I think, along with the Decemberists and Modest Mouse, also from the Pacific Northwest, the most successful band of the post-alternative era in terms of rising from the indie underground to selling out places like Madison Square Garden. No two ways about it. Originally a solo project by guitarist-vocalist Ben Gibbard, formed in the Bayside college town of Bellingham, Washington, the group grew as each album came out. Eventually, Transatlanticism really put them on the map. 2003, they were Seth's favorite band on the OC, all over the soundtrack of that show. Got bigger and bigger as they progressed. They were guests on Sound Opinions in 2008 when they were touring behind Narrow Stairs, but they haven't been heard from since 2011. The last album was Codes and Keys. Members of the group have done lots of other things, in particular Gibbard, who I think you could argue is almost as well-loved for his other band, The Postal Service, as he is for Death Cab for Cutie. Now Death Cab for Cutie is back. Gibbard has weathered some changes in his life. He had a 3-year marriage to Zooey Deschanel. There's a lot of talk about that on this album. There's also talk about him splitting with the main man in Death Cab for Cutie from the beginning, along with him, Chris Walla, who previously produced all the albums. He plays on this record, but in the middle of making it, he said he was going to be leaving the band, and for the first time, the group is working with an outside producer. Let's hear a song from the record, and we'll come back and we'll give our reviews. This is Ingenue by Death Cab for Cutie from Kintsugi on Sound Opinions.
That is Ingenue from the new Death Cab for Cutie album, Kintsugi. Ben Gibbard in bittersweet mode there, a little bit bitter, more bitter than sweet, I would say.
Well, what do you think
song.
The Ingenue is?
Yes. Well, you mentioned the breakup with Zooey Deschanel, and I think that's the main theme in this record, without a doubt. I mean, he has been upfront about that in interviews since the record has come out, so I don't think it's any big secret that this record is basically about that relationship. And for me, Jim, you know, the turmoil within the band, you know, Wallace sort of basically stepping out at the end of it, makes this feel more and more like a solo album rather than a Death Cab for Cutie band album. The band is very submerged in this recording. They play a vital role, but they're really not as upfront as Gibbard is with his vocals and melodies. It's very much about him, very much about his relationship with his former wife. Costi, the new producer, really doesn't take it too big of a role in steering their sound in one direction or another. I hear a little bit of a link to the Postal Service's electronics emerging with the formerly guitar-based Death Cab for Cutie sound. A lot more keyboards on this record as opposed to guitar playing. The one thing that it had the potential to be was very self-pitying, very melodramatic. It's none of those things. Gibbard sings with a lot of restraint. The melodies are strong. But I think it's a transitional album in a lot of ways. You know, there are some insights into this relationship. But I feel like Death Cab is moving on. Gibbard had to get this record out of his system. And we'll see what the new Death Cab for Cutie is on the next record. You know, as a result, I don't think it's as strong as their best work. It's a try-it record for me.
I think I like it a lot more than you do, Greg. I wouldn't want to listen to this 24/7 or every day of the week, right? But all of us have our Death Cab for Cutie moments, right, where we're feeling
a
little melancholy. Right? Nobody does melancholy better than Ben Gibbard. I think your distinctions there are far too fine. This started as a solo project. It's always been a solo project. Chris Walla, very, very, very valuable sideman, but it's always been all about Gibbard. Now, he started bringing in the Postal Service keyboard-heavy stuff with Narrow Stairs, more electronics, the last album, even more so here. But I just think it's another fine collection of songs of him being wondering about his place in life, wondering about the nature of romance. I just love this line, "How could something so fair be so cruel?" There's no venom there. You know, he's not dissing Zooey Deschanel. He's wondering about where he failed. He's wondering about, you know, what is love and what is a relationship? And, man, who among us has not been there? I like this album quite a bit. It's a buy it for me. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to look at artists who were in famous rock bands and ended up doing solo records and play some of our favorites.
As always, Greg, we have some thank yous to say on the way out. Special thanks to Mary Gaffney, Adam Yaffe, and Andrew Gill for the Slater-Kinney session. Sound Opinions is produced by Jason Saldana, Robin Lynn, Evan Chung, and our intern, Alex Claiborne.
I got an anonymous. anonymous phone call from someone last night, and a voice soft and low said, "Listen here, friend, your girl's going out with some other guy, and I think you should know." No.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline,
888-859-1800.
New messages.
I hung up the phone and I went to...
This is Michael McCarville from Austin, Texas. I was just calling regarding the Hal Blaine show. I grew up listening to a lot of the Beach Boys because of my grandpa, especially Pet Sounds. So kind of broke my heart to hear that it wasn't the Beach Boys actually playing on that album at all.
We're having a little, the drum thing seems to be a little inconsistent in those diddle it, diddle it, diddle it, diddle. Move in on that B, that very low B when the trombones slide. Can you move in for that B? Okay. Just blow your guts out. All right, here we go. Take four.
Thanks for the update, and I'm definitely going to be looking more into the Wrecking Crew. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Hello, my name is Karen Morby. I just listened to the show about the Wrecking Crew. Thank you. Thank you so much for maybe the best half hour of the last 66 years. That was my music, and I knew it wasn't those guys playing. Now I know who it was. Thank you. Thank you. That was amazing. Bye.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Julian from outside of Norristown, Pennsylvania. I'm calling about Wolf Alice, not so much the band as their name. I recognized really quickly that they actually take their name from a short story by one of my favorite authors, Angela Carter, specifically the last story in her cult classic collection of gothic short stories and fairy tale adaptations, The Bloody Chamber from 1979. Sort of appropriate that in the Year of the Woman, as you put it, a band would take their name from a late great feminist novelist and short story writer such as Carter. Anyway, you know, don't let the werewolf bite. Bye.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is John from Downers Grove. Sometimes you guys just say things that irritate the heck out of me, and I rake you over the coals in a telephone comment that, of course, you never air. But today, Greg, you have put yourself up on a pedestal with me by mentioning the Roach Sisters and Losing True with Robert Fripp. Last time I listened to that song, other than listening to it today on the show, I haven't been able to listen to it without crying. It's so wonderful. If there's a God, if the phrase "touched by the hand of God" means anything, then the Roaches and Fripp were touched by the hand of God when they did that song. Whatever your bad, you know, mistakes in the past are, you certainly have redeemed yourself by naming this song as one of your Desert Island Jukebox selections. Bless you. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.